The Curbsiders Teach podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. And the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions.
Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the speakers and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity. You should always do your homework and give us any feedback.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Teach Season 4, our series on health professions education. I'm Dr. Molly Hoyblein, joined by my co-host, Dr. Ira Krzyzanowskaya. Today, we have a special episode where we get to sit down in person with three fantastic guests to recap our experience here at AIM Week. We got to sit down with Drs. Shelley Ann Fluker, Caroline Chan, and Jen Olenek. Before we get started with that, Ira, will you remind the audience what we do on the show?
You got it, Molly. We are the Health Professions Podcast for all things education. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls, practice-changing knowledge, to inspire the next generation of clinician educators. We have a great conversation with our guests today, Drs. Jen Olenek, Carolyn Chan, Shelley Ann Fluker. We recap amazing workshops at AIM Week 24. We talk about gamification, feedback literacy, clinical reasoning remediation, professionalism, and with a framing, of course, of a growth mindset, and so much more.
It was a really great conversation. We're very excited to share it with you. So I'll tell you a little more about our guests. Dr. Jen Olenek is a hospitalist and palliative care physician at UPenn and co-director of the Internal Medicine Sabbat Internship and co-director of the novel fourth-year palliative care curriculum in the medical school.
Dr. Shelley Ann Fluker is a general internist who is a faculty member at Emory University, clinically based at Grady Memorial Hospital, Atlanta's Safety Net Hospital. She is the primary care track program director and associate director of the Grady Liver Clinic, a primary care-based hepatitis C clinic.
And Dr. Caroline Chan is an assistant professor of clinical medicine at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. She practices internal medicine and addiction medicine. She's the co-host of the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine Podcast, Season 3, coming July 2024.
We are so excited to bring you this season of Curbsiders Teach with the support of and in partnership with the Alliance of Academic Internal Medicine. A reminder that most episodes will be available for CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Thank you to our Patreon members. If you love all the Curbsiders content and you haven't yet joined the Patreon, please consider supporting us and continuing to bring you this amazing resource.
So without further ado, let's get to it. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. We're so excited to sit down in person here at the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine and just share some of our pearls from the conference, some of the things that we're excited about bringing home today. Dr. Chan, we'll start with you. Are you okay if we call you Caroline for this recording?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, Caroline, great to see you again in person and excited to have you on Teach for the first time. You've been on many other Curbsiders.
Yeah, it's great to be here. I'm huge fans of you guys, so it's a little surreal just being on the other end.
Yeah. Well, what's been most exciting for you about the conference, or what kind of has surprised you the most in the last few days?
I just really love the energy of AIM. You know, it's really cool to just have a bunch of clinician educators getting together and nerding out, which has been a ton of fun. And then there were just so many great sessions to choose from. It was hard to even pick pearls that I wanted to do, quite honestly.
Well, we're so excited to hear your pearls, Carolyn, and thank you also for handling me running up to you in the middle of AIM and being like, oh my God, in person. So it's just that it's the kind of, I feel like the vibe of the conference. So it's really nice to see you again. And Dr. Fluker, is it okay if we call you Shelley Ann?
Absolutely.
Well, Shelley Ann, tell us a little bit about your experience at the conference and about yourself.
Well, in terms of the conference, as Carolyn said, I agree. There's so much energy here. It's definitely another great AIM meeting. But actually, the thing that I've enjoyed really is Columbus. This is my first time here, and it's really a lovely city. We've had great weather. We've had great food. And so I've just enjoyed coming to a new city. In terms of myself, I'm from Jamaica, so I got to shout that out. So everybody knows that, to all my Jamaicans out there. I live in Atlanta, where I work at Emory University, as y'all talked about. And I'm approaching empty nesthood. My son's in college and is finishing up his first year. My daughter's 16, and I'm really excited to be an empty nester soon. So.
And we have someone else here joining us today. Dr. Olenek, is it okay if we call you Jen?
Please.
Yes. Well, tell us a little about yourself and what's been maybe most surprising or exciting for you about the conference.
Great. So I live in Philly. I work at Penn. I'm a palliative care doc and a hospitalist, and I'm lucky to have roles in both of those in the med school. I was most surprised and excited about seeing so many people from med school and residency, especially being here as my first time leaving my one-year-old daughter. So really getting to celebrate, you know, a different aspect of my life and reuniting with people from med school and residency has been the best, including Ira.
Well, I would agree with all of you. I mean, I think one of the things for me that's been the most fun is the presenters are amazing in the sessions, but then the group energy, bringing together other, you know, other ideas or other approaches and just really sharing together best approaches and learning together has been really special. So happy to be here.
Totally agree. I didn't know we were going to do what we love too, but I agree. I feel like the fact that we have this amazing group here today talking, but also just being able to be in workshops with people, meet new people, and really kind of observe what lights them up, what's their fire, their passion. It's kind of like meta-learning. I feel like I'm not just learning about the person, I'm learning about the content and learning about myself and my own reaction to the content. So I feel like this conference just jazzes me up in so many ways. With that intro, should we get to some recaps of the conference?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm so excited to talk about this one. The session, it was so much fun. It was called Gamification, What's My Prize? Using Gamification in Your Teaching Practice with Dr. Aisha Crowley and Dr. Jennifer Jeremiah. They introed and introduced the section, the entire session using The Price is Right. So they actually had us put our names on like little popsicle sticks, which I thought was actually a really fun way to think about how you can actually engage learners kind of using, you know, like a random draw pull method. And they used it to actually teach high value care, which is super cool. And they even had a Plinko. So they like literally, kudos to them for, I'm not quite sure how they physically brought this Plinko board in, but they built it and brought it in, and it was really cool. I think what was the most helpful take home that I want to hopefully integrate in my own practice is they actually gave a taxonomy of game elements. So this idea that you can like really pick and choose what you want to use to integrate within your own teaching was cool. So the taxonomy that they gave us was like performance, personal, fictional, ecological, and social. And to give an example, I really liked how they talked about the ecological model, where they gave an example of imposed choice and chance, which is what we do every day in clinical practice, right? We often have constraints and how we can actually use those game aspects to teach our learners some of the realities of clinical practice was really cool.
Can I ask, Carolyn, how do you see yourself using gamification in your day-to-day teaching?
I think I actually want to do something similar with high-value care for addiction medicine costs, which I think would be really interesting, thinking about how much does it cost for urine drug screens and different medications and sort of using a similar model. And I want to add theme music to it and like buzzers, and I want to make it very noisy. That's how I'm picturing it.
Very cool. And you also attended another workshop that I was there as well. What kind of pearls did you take from that?
I attended this great session on the assessment and advancement. How do you utilize competencies and ACGME milestones? How to provide feedback and faculty development to clinician educators? That was led by Dr. Francis Colachio, Dr. Annie Im, Dr. Abhishek Kumar, and Dr. Arun Fagki. And what I thought was really cool is they took the idea of clinical competency committee. So if you're not familiar, these are meetings that residency programs have to just kind of check in and see how learners are doing and progressing. But they actually suggested turning it on its head and doing it for faculty. So they had actually taken learners and sort of provided a similar group model and meeting where they would actually chat about faculty and how to improve and then give kind of like, you know, narrative comments about what they had discussed to really get meaningful feedback. Because I feel like that's something I often don't get enough as a faculty is meaningful feedback. So I thought that was a pretty cool idea.
Well, thanks for sharing those, Caroline. Shelly-Ann, I know you and Ira presented an amazing session. Could you tell us a little bit more about growth mindset and professionalism and how that session went for you?
Yeah, no, I'm really excited that you gave us an opportunity to talk about that because it was a great workshop. So we presented it along with Nora Osman and Mary Montgomery. And we spoke about the fact that currently the model that we use to assess professionalism of trainees is really a deficit model. And so we really basically assume that trainees know what we mean by professionalism, understand how to be professional, and we kind of wait to see if they demonstrate professional behaviors. And then when they don't, we get really mad and upset and have all these emotions about it. And then we also struggle to help them to develop the skills that we define as professionalism. We also talked about how that term professionalism is just murky, and it's just even difficult to understand what you mean. We know it when we see it, but it's also hard to sort of define it in a way that helps us to basically develop those skills in our trainees. And so we really started from a point of talking about how we need to kind of throw that term out and really think about how our emotions impact us and how we can sort of move forward. What else would you add?
Yeah, Cheyenne actually walked us through in the workshop exactly kind of like what we think of or maybe define professionalism, which is that it's pretty still murky, as you mentioned. And I think for us in GME, we have an area for opportunity in terms of when we think about competencies relative to professionalism, because some of them will say things like demonstrates professional behavior in settings. And we commented about how vague that is and how we need more descriptors about really what is professional behavior, what are the domains. And as we talk about moving to a growth mindset framework and one that's oriented in, you know, transparency and that we need training and what kind of professional behavior looks like and that we need kind of really specific metrics, we pulled up the model that was developed from HMS around professionalism and the various domains, ethical conduct, accountability, well-being, there's a fourth one that I can't remember, and really just looking at that and saying, where is the area of maybe opportunity for this learner? Where can they improve? And being very specific about that and not labeling the person as unprofessional, but that that behavior is not kind of meeting standards according to accountability. Is that
yeah, no, I completely agree. And the thing I would add, and this really came from Mary and Nora, and I'm just so grateful that they...
we tagged along.
Yeah, exactly. Just that, you know, we should think about professionalism just like we think about any other skill. Like we think about physical examination, medical knowledge, and we should have expectations, and those should be clearly set, which they've developed at HMS. And then we should communicate that to our learners and then really expect them to grow in those skills over time, just as how they grow in skills over time in their physical exam, and not get upset, not get angry when they don't meet one of those skills. Like, we don't get angry when somebody doesn't know how to do the cardiac exam. We teach them how to do it. So I think that piece was really, really resonated with me and with our participants in the room.
I found that really powerful too. Yeah, that we just expect students to, or residents to, come in professional, and, you know, we label them as unprofessional if they're not, rather than seeing it across that continuum and seeing that they, you know, aren't necessarily expected to have those skills coming in. That's why they're here as learners and we're here to help them.
And I just want to shout out one thing, which is that from like a presentation kind of standpoint, and Carolyn, I think you kind of brought us up to speed with gamification and kind of making things truly engaging. I have to shout out Mary Montgomery, because she came up with this exercise at the beginning of the workshop where you open an envelope, and in that envelope is an email from someone. Maybe it's a clinic director, maybe it's your division chief, maybe it's somebody who does clinician educator kind of feedback conversations. And it's basically telling you, like, you're claiming CME for sessions that you haven't been to fully, or like just something that would be labeled unprofessional, and gave the audience a chance to like think, pair, share, and just discuss the emotional experience of that. And I feel like that basically set us up for success. And I think, you know, it wasn't quite as sexy and awesome as gamification that Carolyn taught us about, but I do think really like took that moment to say, what is the emotional valence of something being labeled unprofessional or having to meet with somebody because of professionalism issue, and having that, seeing it written, I thought was just like, from a presentation like standpoint, and also just to get us ready to talk about the content. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. Like, it was like a crescendo of noise in the room as people were pairing and sharing. So I thought that really set us up for success.
I actually want to pick your brain. I'm curious. I feel like large learning models, large language models, LLMs, it's a little bit early. I could use more coffee. Have been kind of a theme of this conference about how it's being integrated into medical education. So I'm curious, like, do you see a role for using these tools in professionalism or with some of the work that you're doing?
The answer is probably yes, because I think that's the answer for everything when we talk about large learning models. But I haven't thought through it enough to think about how it would be utilized. And I'm still really becoming more building up my sort of knowledge and skill set in using them. What do the rest of you think?
I think one thing that, this is a great question, Carolyn, one thing that we had talked about with the folks, we did an episode on AI, actually, and recapping kind of some of the highlights from this conference around that, was using AI for coaching. And kind of whether it's for medical students or there's folks who are working kind of in Ohio on resident coaches potentially, but whether or not we could see a role for a large language model or AI in some format helping you say, hey, you got this kind of written feedback or this verbal feedback around behavior, kind of what do you think about it? Where can we move towards, you know, a growth mindset around, I don't know, showing up for rounds and not being on TikTok or whatever, you know, whatever it is. But I do think there's going to be room for that. It's just a question of like, how much AI do you want in your daily life and that thing coaching you through being a human. I don't know.
I was going to say, what a great specific piece of feedback. What do you think about not being on TikTok during rounds? What would that feel like?
That was an example that came up in our workshop.
And that's, you know, kind of an aspirational goal that may be coming in the next few years. You know, the technology is not there yet, but some really exciting people working on that kind of thing. One thing Dr. Chris Chu, who works on some of the other Curbsiders podcasts, and I were talking about yesterday was he actually uses it to, and hopefully he's okay with me sharing this, but if he's feeling emotionally triggered by something and like responding to an email, he'll write that and then pop it into ChatGPT and say, rewrite this more professionally. So he gets to write it in his voice and then he gets to send it in a professional voice. So I liked that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, well, thank you, Ira and Shelianne, for telling us a little more about your workshop. And I know you attended some other workshops, Shelianne, that resonated with you or that you're excited to take back.
Yeah, another workshop that I really enjoyed, coming from the primary care track program director viewpoint, is the workshop From Ward to Clinic, a Longitudinal Ambulatory-Centric POCUS Curriculum for Internal Medicine Residents, which was led by Spencer Weintraub and Alexander Smith, who are chief residents, along with Christina DiAgostino, please forgive me if I mispronounced your name, Christina, and Lauren Block. And so they started off their workshop by really talking about how there's really very few places that have ambulatory POCUS curriculums. Like, it's much more robust in our residency training programs on the inpatient setting, but less so on the outpatient setting. They then went through and described their curriculum, which really built on their inpatient POCUS curriculum. And then they added a component with three in-person and three virtual sessions focusing on outpatient POCUS. But what I really took away and enjoyed from it are some of the ways that they have sort of overcome the barriers. Because I'm sure everybody out there who's been thinking about implementing a POCUS ambulatory curriculum is immediately thinking about all the barriers. And that's definitely what I went into it with, was tell me how to overcome the barriers. And so one of the things that really struck me was their use of near-peer mentors, or near-peer educators, I should say. And they described some of the literature about the effectiveness of that. And so in this case, it was their chief residents. So the two chief residents who helped lead the workshop are the POCUS chiefs, and that's been incorporated into part of their teaching duties or part of their chief duties. And actually, it was really cool because they were awesome. They did such an amazing job in this workshop. And I was like, okay, I can see why you guys are doing an awesome job as the lead educators for this POCUS curriculum. But they talked about how that frees up the faculty. The faculty can support the chief residents as the main educators, but you don't have to depend completely on the faculty to teach. And so I found that as very helpful in thinking about one of the barriers that definitely I am dealing with as I try to implement a POCUS curriculum. And then they then went on to talk about some of their objectives and evaluation and how they're going to move forward in the future. So definitely gave me a lot of food for thought in thinking about how to implement a curriculum like that at my institution. And definitely that piece about thinking more about near-peer educators to extend your teaching faculty definitely resonated with me.
I feel like POCUS is something that we should have like clinician educator competencies for, because I do think in the ambulatory setting, it's just my mind also went to the barriers, Shelly-Ann, just like you said, and also like the knowledge gap for me, and to know that I want to include that curriculum, something that I don't know very well. It's like, you know, we talk about also the emotional valence. I feel like I'm like, oh my God, am I impostering? Like, I don't know this stuff. I need to, and that's where your comment around having near peer people who are around you who do know this content area sharing. And I think that's pretty powerful.
And just to validate you, I also don't know much about outpatient POCUS. And I think that has been one of my barriers. But yeah, and afterwards, I actually had a conversation with one of our junior faculty members who finished up chief year recently. And I was like, will you help me with this? And she was like, sure. So yeah, I think letting go of the fact that we don't have to be the expert in everything that we are leading in terms of our curriculum was really helpful to me.
One of my former classmates, Dr. Rebecca Davis, she's at Jefferson. She's doing outpatient POCUS as well. And we were talking about how it's really amazing in the outpatient setting where it takes longer to get studies in radiology, and how POCUS is even more high yield in a lot of ways in the outpatient setting, and how you can bill for it if you have the right setup. So that's also a plus in the outpatient setting.
Well, Shelly-Ann, and I know you also attended another workshop that you had some pearls you wanted to share.
Yeah, the other workshop that I think I'm definitely going to take home some ideas from is Lacks Insight on Receptive to Feedback, Understanding and Improving Feedback Literacy in Trainees. And this was led by Mary Grace Zakulik, Megan Sabaski, Ophelia Martinez, and Marcella Katznelson. And so they talked about this concept of feedback literacy, really focusing it on the trainee perspective. So they talked about the four components of feedback literacy, which are appreciating feedback, making judgment, managing affect, and taking action, and really talked about how you can utilize that to enable your trainee to be an engaged member of the sort of feedback process. They have created a feedback literacy rubric that you can utilize to understand the strengths and weaknesses of your learner. And it was really fun. I know Jen was there as well. They gave a couple video clips of feedback sessions, and then we used the rubric to grade how the trainee performed in those different domains. And again, loud conversations. Everybody got into it. And it was a really helpful way to see how you could then help your learner to sort of say, okay, you're having trouble in, you know, managing your affect, which was definitely a big one. But then they also talked a little bit about how you could use this to teach your trainee, which that really resonated with me. And I think I'm really going to spend some time thinking about doing that. Like, what are some strategies that I could utilize to ensure that my trainees understand what feedback literacy is so that they can be better sort of participants in feedback processes? What about you, Jen? What did you think?
Agreed. I think two takeaways, like you were saying. One is, as the faculty member, the preceptor giving feedback, I'm going to be more mindful of sort of diagnosing my learner where they are in the feedback literacy, which I hadn't thought about before. And then, like you said, creating more education for our learners to be better recipients of feedback and have improved feedback literacy, which we could do, you know, at the beginning of each rotation, for example, to prime them to be able to ask for feedback and receive feedback.
That rubric sounds really cool. Can you tell me, is this something you can hand to a learner like at the start of their rotation? Is it meant to be used like while you're giving feedback with somebody? How do you use this rubric?
So the way that they have it laid out now, I think it's primarily meant to be used by faculty members, because the four domains are then broken down into specific behaviors, and you score them based on like never, rarely, sometimes, always performs that skill. It is a one pager, and I see it could easily be translated into something that you hand to trainees, or maybe even as in its current format, and they could score themselves. What do you think, Jen?
Agreed. I think you could give it at the beginning if you're doing that training session for trainees on thinking about feedback. You could provide that to them at the beginning as a self-reflection tool to create awareness, and have them use it as they're getting feedback, asking for feedback later in the rotation.
And I guess it would be similar to how sometimes we tell trainees, hey, this is how you're going to be graded on this rotation. This is what we're looking for. So it could be something similar to like, this is how we're going to I'm going to think about how you are receiving feedback from me. But I think you could also just make a trainee version of it.
Yeah, talking about transparency, especially with professionalism, because I would put ability to receive feedback in a professionalism domain. So just highlighting your team's work on the transparency piece.
Well, I was going to ask y'all selfishly, as you know, within kind of the program director leadership, within like medical student work too, could you maybe specifically say like, I'm going to use this rubric the next time I orient residents to their primary care clinic or to, you know, the start of their sub-I? Like, where do you see kind of practically, to Carolyn's point, like really giving this as a rubric or adjusting it or even mentioning feedback literacy like in the moment?
Yeah, one place that jumps to mind, and I'm going to give credit to this to the person who was in one of my little small group discussions. She suggested, and I totally agree with her, that this would be great for use in a retreat. So we have our PGY1s are going to be having their sort of rising PGY2 retreat in May, and it focuses on helping them transition to that leadership role of PGY2 year. But I could definitely see having a session for them on feedback literacy that would help them both think about how they receive feedback, but also how they assess their interns now, who they're going to be giving feedback to. So I think that would be a place where it could be utilized as a training opportunity.
Very meta, Shalyan. I loved it. We're a big fan of meta things here.
Well, Jen, I know you also attended a session that you found some really helpful pearls from.
Yes, I want to talk about the workshop entitled Words Matter, a workshop to minimize bias in narrative assessment by Drs. Jenny Sheffield, Kate Weavy, and Mary Finta. I'm a sucker for a compelling call to action, which they had, as well as slides with great visuals and not a lot of words. They also had that, but they gave us practical tips that I'll talk about too. So I really want to highlight how they talked about minimizing bias in assessment starts before you even write your evaluation. It starts on day one of working together or even before, if you're someone like me who sends an expectation intro email prior to starting a rotation. So it starts by maximizing a student or resident's ability to perform by minimizing the things that get in the way, especially for women and underrepresented and minority students. So thinking about all those things that increase cognitive load. And I love how they demonstrated this with a learner with all these thought bubbles above them demonstrating imposter syndrome, although, you know, did highlight the need to sort of flip that word on its head, that it's not really a syndrome. It's a problem, you know, with the system, not the person. And Ginny, one of the presenters, she talks about it's like sending somebody out in a Michigan winter with T-shirt and shorts and telling them they have cold syndrome. So I love that. Another, you know, thought bubble or thing that increases cognitive load is stereotype threat, micro and macroaggressions, and then hidden curriculum. And just how our role as educators and people not only educating but evaluating ultimately is to make those thought bubbles smaller or move those thought bubbles to the back and really bring the opportunity for them to do the best that they can and allow them to grow and learn without all of those things getting in the way of the cognitive load. So specific actions they talked about, they recommended modeling humility and self-doubt, which I think I've done well here so far. Be aware of stereotype threat and imposter syndrome and how much noise and cognitive load that adds. Preparing for microaggressions, addressing them when they happen, and debriefing with the team. And then making your expectations very specific and transparent. And then that really highlights the hidden curriculum. So people who might not have experience within the system, you know, if they don't come from family of doctors, et cetera, they might need even more clear expectations about performance and assessment. So I loved all those tips and, you know, ways to help your assessment and your writing the assessment is to take notes, including on your phone, you know, on your notes app, about really specific observed behaviors that focus on competency-related skills like patient care or medical knowledge. So we're looking at behaviors, not necessarily making inferences. So I loved all that. They packed a lot in, including talking about AI in assessment, ways that it can be, you know, positive or neutral or negative. But I really wanted to highlight that piece about, you know, maximizing students' ability to learn and grow even before you're sitting down writing your assessment.
I feel like this conference had so many overlaps. Like, I was just thinking about how that connects with the workshop that we did. And I don't know, Shalane, if you're feeling the same way.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what struck me. I'm like, it's all about expectations and transparency. And we've definitely had a theme here about talking about best ways to give feedback, right? And the importance of that. So,
were there more things, Jen, from that workshop? I feel like that workshop was a pre-course. Like a whole day.
Could have gone in for, yeah, another hour. I would have happily sat there.
Which we don't say usually. I don't think I have said that I would sit there for another hour in a workshop in a very long time. So that's a re-endorsement for
absolutely
that one.
Very cool. Well, I wanted to highlight one that I went to, which was the Curriculum Makeover, How to Modernize and Streamline Your Didactics with Drs. Neha Deshpande, Susan Merrill, Ashwini Azidi, and Nicole Oakman. I'm sorry if I got anyone's name wrong there. But they went through a really nice example of how they looked at their whole didactic curriculum for the medicine clerkship and have a large system. And so really had to take the time to map out how things overlap and, you know, are there things that maybe they're spending too much time on or not enough time on? And it really created a rich discussion among the attendees about how it works at different places. And there was really a lot of bidirectional learning and morphed into a bigger discussion about what do learners actually want today in terms of in-person didactics or more skills-based things and more asynchronous learning. And I think we're in a period of transition where learners are looking for, you know, and using a lot of those technologies to learn on their own. And then where does that leave us as educators to really make that in-person time more about skills building and communication and building relationships? And so that was interesting. And then they also highlighted a program that was done at Johns Hopkins where they had a fourth-year medical student who's doing a rotation, like a selective specialty rotation in medical education. And as part of it, that student worked with the faculty to review all of the didactic materials that the faculty had put together and looked at it through an anti-bias lens. And so gave specific feedback to the faculty that maybe had stereotypes or biases kind of built into clinical cases. And I think that was just a really nice example of hopefully those of us in kind of core clinical education are aware of, you know, not adding extraneous information that doesn't actually help the clinical case and might, you know, extend stereotypes. But I'm sure there are some of us who maybe made a lecture 10 years ago and that was the style of things back then and maybe haven't thought about updating our materials. And one of the presenters, so they shared a few cases for us to sort of work through and point out things. And I loved that she actually admitted after the fact that, hey, this was a case I wrote in residency, which was not that long ago. And it had all the things you're not supposed to do. And I think it shows, you know, that we really are trying to make progress in this, but also we need to keep being aware of it and keep trying to work on it.
I also think that's amazing role modeling of vulnerability and humanity to say, like, this is me.
Yes.
Yesterday. Yeah. Or, like, or, you know, 10 years ago, whatever, just to say, like, we all have areas of growth. And then she's presenting on it. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, to kind of piggyback off of the areas of growth, I think one of mine, and I don't know if this resonates with the group here, is kind of helping learners around clinical reasoning and, like, specifically remediation in that realm. It's not something I think I consciously do or label or say that I'm doing. And I went to this amazing workshop called Beyond Diagnosis, Remediation Strategies for Clinical Reasoning by Dr. Christy Deep, Dr. Sarah Vick, and Dr. Megan Wallach from the University of Kentucky. And just shout out to their presentation style. Like, they were engaged with us. They were walking around the room, very Dr. Nora Osman of them. They were just kind of keeping the energy high. And we were all super focused on, like, how do we figure out what's the symptom? Like, what are we observing in the learner? What's the true primary problem, like the clinical reasoning deficit? And then how do you develop a plan? And they kind of showed us this pyramid structure from hypothesis generation to kind of hypothesis, problem representation, data synthesis, management plan. I'm probably mixing up those pyramids layers. Apologies from the folks at Kentucky. But basically giving us cases to say, when you see that a learner has an issue with, let's say, hypothesis generation or premature closure, what do you do? And then they actually gave us like the TX. They said, you know, walk through, do not miss diagnoses, and kind of what are the most likely diagnoses. And then we actually, you know, talked about it as a large group, which I feel like case discussion as a large group can get super unwieldy. And, you know, there's people out there who can manage it. Shout out Dr. Nora Osman again. And they did that. And we walked through, you know, other issues. What happens when you're not creating the right or accurate problem representation and you're not clear on who has what symptom for how long? What do you do for the learner? You can go through qualifiers. They have like this buy a qualifier game where you have to say, is it acute on chronic? Is it, you know, simple or complicated, and kind of helping learners specifically say what the problem representation is and how that helps them come up with the diagnosis. And they gave a lot of other examples around kind of developing the differential diagnosis and being able to synthesize, and how do you recognize kind of key features in the patient's presentation, and even going through with learners, like highlight the key features in this note so that we can kind of go through this together. Yeah, they blew my mind in terms of like really going through specific parts of that pyramid. And then they were saying, like, what do you do if a learner has multiple issues, like it's hypothesis generation and data synthesis and problem representation? And they basically said, start at the lowest and work your way up, meaning like once that learner has kind of shown that there's competency in hypothesis generation, then you go to the next step. And you don't try to tackle all the things at once, which sometimes I might try to do, being like a little pearl on this, a little pearl on that. And you really do have to start kind of on the, you know, foundational level and build up. So
I love that. I feel like we might need to do a whole episode on that.
So. I think so, yeah. Too. I was sitting there being like, can't write fast enough. Like, we're like,
too
my
many
little
pearls.
Yeah.
Great. Well, this has been so great to sit down and share pearls. And we're excited to share these with our audience. Before we head out, are there any last take home thoughts you have to leave people with, or anything that you're working on that you'd like to plug? Anything you have coming out soon, or something, a project you're excited about that you're working on?
Well, I think the only thing, and I was saying this before we started recording, as a more senior person here in the room today, it's just nice to come to conferences like this and just like learn and grow. Like, I'm still learning, I'm still growing. And I think it's really important reminder that we have to all continue to allow ourselves time and opportunity to continue to evolve as educators.
I love the growth mindset.
Yes. I'm feeling so inspired and reinvigorated. You know, I think we all work so hard, and it is just so nice to be reminded of why we work hard and the community that we have. So I'm so grateful for that. And I really learned a lot about AI.
Yes. I think we're all going to do
that. I'm going to, you know, I went to ChatGPT for the first time. It's probably not even how you talk about it. I logged into ChatGPT.
I've never been on it yet. You're okay.
Yesterday.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to look into that and think about it with assessment and whatnot, writing narratives, different things.
Have you tried Open Evidence?
Not yet.
So it's just for clinical, but amazing to just be like, what's the best ACE inhibitor? And then I'll be like, telmisartan has the highest blood pressure reduction. And give you sources from PubMed.
Yeah, this was my first time learning about Open Evidence. Yeah. And I was like, okay, using that next week.
Yeah, truly the most up-to-date resource that's out there with the citations. I agree.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders series, The Curbsiders Teach. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/teach. A special thanks to the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine for helping make this season possible, and to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project. Thanks to the team at PodPace for editing and production support. Until next time, I've been Dr. Molly Hoyblein.
And we're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecurbsidersteach@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And I've been Dr. Ira Krasnovskaya. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you a little nugget of medical edutainment.
And gems.
And gems, capital G.
Yummy.